Today we're here with Professor Rob Herbert. We are going to be talking evidence-based practice. So hello, Rob. Thank you for joining us today. I was wondering if you could start by letting everyone know just where you are and what you do, so that we have an understanding of your work, and then we'll get on to the topic of evidence-based practice.
Okay, well, I'm a Senior Principal Research Fellow at Neuroscience Research Australia, which it has a short name of NEURA, and I'm a professor in the School of Medical Sciences at the University of New South Wales. I'm a physiotherapist by training, and I spend my days doing research into both physiotherapy, particularly clinical research in physiotherapy, but also research in mechanical properties of muscles.
What kind of clinical areas of research do you work in?
I've really dabbled in just about everything. My main interest is in rehabilitation and particularly in the management of contracture. I've done quite a bit of research with my wife, Lisa Harvey, who's a physiotherapist and a researcher who's very interested in that field. But really, I've dabbled quite a bit in low back pain and in a whole lot of other areas of physiotherapy as well.
So no specific clinical area, just looking at the evidence really for physiotherapy intervention. Right?
Yeah, I'm interested in the breadth of physiotherapy, although I'm not an expert in anything really. My real expertise is as a research methodologist, and that translates pretty comfortably across to most areas of physiotherapy.
Absolutely. And you were involved in founding Pedro, am I correct in saying that?
Yes, that's right, with my colleagues Kathy Sherrington and Mosley, Chris Maher and Mark Elkins. We started it up, well, we started in 1998, we got it on the web in 1999.
Oh, wow. That's a long time.
So we've just had our 15th anniversary. Pedro is 15 years old.
I did know that, actually, but now you say it again, that's such a long time. That's congratulations for keeping it going that long.
So Pedro is now a pimply adolescent.
Yeah. So what was the reasoning behind setting up Pedro?
At the time, I was teaching undergraduate physiotherapy students at the University of Sydney, and it was originally an optional part of the curriculum. It later became a mandatory part of the curriculum, but in that unit of study, students were required to examine the evidence investigating the effectiveness of a particular physiotherapy intervention. So they had to go out and find themselves some typically randomized controlled trials. And back in those days, they had a terribly hard time doing it. So I started building up a database, a personal database, both from my own sources and from the sources that the students themselves found. And after a few years, it started getting fairly big and it started becoming a useful resource. So I started chatting to Kathy Sherrington, and we decided we'd put it on the web, and that's how it all began.
It's funny how these things start from something that you do to help yourself. So a personal tool that you build to help yourself. It's funny how, because that's where Physiopedia came from originally as well. Just something that I did to help my own CPD. So it's interesting to hear you say that you built something for your students, and that's where Pedro came from. I think.
And probably like Physiopedia, we never dreamed that Pedro would become big and used by lots of people all over the world. I imagine it's exactly the same with Physiopedia.
Yeah, I guess if you build something that you actually need in the start, then everyone else is going to find it useful as well. If you build something that there isn't a need for, then it doesn't get used. So I guess that's where the success comes from, which is good. So I hope we're around at 15 years as well, as going as strong as Pedro.
Yeah.
So that was back in 1998, you said. So that was soon, I guess evidence-based practice is about 20 odd years old now. That must have been in the early days of evidence-based practice at the University of Sydney, or teaching students.
I'd like to think we were teaching it before the phrase had been coined, because we were teaching critical appraisal of randomised controlled trials, a specific part of evidence-based practice, in the very early 90s. And I think the historians would say that it's somewhere around 1992 that the word started coming into use.
And so, I mean, that's 20 years ago, and I was a student then, and I remember working with evidence-based practice throughout my studies from back then. How do you think its evidence-based practice has changed over the last 20 years?
I think it's become part of the psychology of physiotherapists. In 1992, it was radical, dangerous, outrageous, and people were very, or some people were very resistant to the idea. There was initially quite a lot of opposition, and I think now the profession has made its peace with evidence-based practice. We've just sort of incorporated it into the way we think. And I've seen that at conferences. In the early 1990s, if you went to a physiotherapy conference anywhere in the world, people would stand up and they would talk about their personal experiences. They would talk about theories that they'd developed by reading physiology or biomechanics. But they'd never talk about evidence in the sense of, for example, the direct test of the effectiveness of an intervention on people in the clinic, or the measures of the accuracy of a diagnostic test tested in the clinic, or the prognostic value of some prediction rule tested on patients in the clinic. It was very experience-based and theory-based, but not evidence-based. Now, I think, at least in some countries in the world, certainly not in all, we're used to people being expected to provide evidence when they make assertions about clinical practice, and that's a really radical change. I think a lot of young people won't understand just how much the profession has changed in 20 years. I think it's a radically different profession to what it was back in those times. And I think underneath it all, it's even more different than it appears superficially, because even though practices change slowly, I think the way in which people are thinking is different, and that's more important and more fundamental.
And I guess that if people are thinking differently, they are teaching differently as well. And so that gives strength to the people coming into the profession, the people that were the new physiotherapists and the new people coming in. Do you think we've become more stronger as a profession in the eyes of other healthcare professions because we've become more research-based? Or because we think more about the evidence and use evidence-based practice?
I do. I think we've actually been a research-based profession for a long time. I think physiotherapists started using their understanding of the basic sciences quite a long time ago, at least in some countries, and probably in most countries. The more recent and perhaps more important transition was the transition to using what evidence-based practice people call evidence, and by which I mean direct tests using rigorous research on patients in the clinic. And I think that's given us a high level of credibility.
That's the word I was looking for.
I always remember as an undergraduate physiotherapist and a recent graduate getting taunted by orthopedic surgeons who used to say, you know, you haven't got any evidence for what you do. Well, we now leave orthopedic surgeons in the shade. The number of randomized controlled trials, I keep picking on randomized trials because that's what I know about most. I'm not pretending that's the only sort of evidence that we need. But when it comes to randomized trials, we now have, I think the latest count is over 23,000 randomized trials. The orthopedic surgeons don't come close. Most of what they do is not based on rigorous research conducted on comparative research from randomized studies, and so we can taunt them now. It's our turn.
So evidence-based practice is not just about the published research. From the original model, if we think about it, includes clinical knowledge and patient values as well. Do you think we focus too much on just the published research and forget about those other two aspects of it, or do you think that everybody, do you think that we naturally include those in the work that we do?
Actually, yeah, my colleagues, Gry Jarmfert, Corey Berger-Hagen, and Judy Mead, who I wrote the textbook on practical evidence-based physiotherapy, the four of us have spent a lot of time talking about this issue, and we're not so fond of the original definition put up by David Sackett and others, which says that that evidence-based practice is the use of the best available evidence in conjunction with patient values and clinical expertise. I think a fairer way of characterising evidence-based practice is it's physiotherapists and health professions have always used clinical expertise, and to lesser degrees have considered patient values. One of the things that the evidence-based medicine people have brought to the table is a more explicit use, an explication of patients' values, and a more explicit use of them in clinical decision making. But the thing that fundamentally distinguishes, in my view, in our view, evidence-based practice from other sorts of practice is the use of evidence.
Okay.
And by evidence we mean not just research, because doctors and physiotherapists have used research for a very long time, one way or another. It's a particular sort of research. It's the research. It's high quality research, and it's research on patients in the clinic. That's what distinguishes evidence-based practice from. It's one of the fundamental things that distinguishes evidence-based practice from other forms of practice. There are other features as well. There's the explicit acknowledgement of uncertainty. There's the systematic use of evidence in clinical decision making. There's the systematic and critical use of evidence, trying to distinguish high quality evidence from low quality evidence. And there are various other features also that distinguish evidence-based practice from other modes of practice. But I think the most fundamental thing is the use of evidence.
Yeah. So the evidence that we use the evidence a lot more now, like you say, to make our practice evidence-based. A lot of the work that people have done with the evidence has been to develop clinical guidelines and sort of clinical decision-making tools that might guide our practice. Do you think this is a good direction to take with the evidence, what we're doing with the evidence?
Yes, with some reservations. The great thing about guidelines is that they relieve the individual practitioner of the job of finding and critically appraising the best evidence. And in general, that's a big job, it's very time consuming, and it requires a high degree of expertise. So good clinical practice guidelines are a great thing. Of course, they're not rules, they're just recommendations, and they can make life a lot easier for the practitioner who doesn't want to spend their life reading technical papers. There are some people who like that sort of thing, but most people just want to get on with the job.
Yeah.
There's a dark side to guidelines as well, and you know, many people would appreciate them. One is that guidelines can be a mechanism by which individuals can pursue their particular worldviews, and guidelines are not always very evidence-based. On Pedro, we make the distinction, we try to make the distinction between evidence-based and non-evidence-based guidelines, but it's not a very easy distinction to make, and there's probably a spectrum from non-evidence-based to highly evidence-based clinical practice guidelines. And of course, there are ones that are written in a way that is useful and easy to use and easy to incorporate in clinical practice, and others that are turgid, technical, and unhelpful.
Yeah.
But the good ones are great, and that's what we should aspire to.
Yeah, I think the important thing to remember about the guidelines is that they are just recommendations, aren't they? It would be very easy for new generation or younger graduates to think that they are to be followed. So it's important to remember that they're just a recommendation for practice, which we should be aware of, I guess.
I think most physiotherapists, and for that matter most doctors, don't have too much of a hard time remembering that.
Yeah.
Independence is something that comes fairly naturally to most health professionals. And at least in Australia, I think it's probably true in the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Physiotherapists don't like too much being told what to do. They're happy to listen to other people's opinions, particularly if they're informed opinions. But I don't think too many people are going to feel too constrained by the piece of paper sitting on their desk.
With clinical guidelines coming out from all the evidence, so let's just use clinical guidelines as an example. There are other tools as well. But and I guess with some of the more high-level evidence, it seems to be informing practice from a stakeholder's point of view. So in some countries, so insurance companies might be dictating what people are supposed to do to patients, how many times they should see them. This is one of the problems that's come out of from the evidence-based practice movement, I guess, and the development of all the guidelines. This is a bit of a problem, isn't it, for physiotherapy in some places?
Yeah. I know that when some of the early back pain guidelines came out, the recommendations were really do a lot less than you're currently doing. Most of the back pain guidelines recommend fairly minimal intervention for acute low back pain, and that's not something that was not necessarily well received by the profession. Sometimes it was treated with suspicion. It was seen to be reflecting the agendas of other professions, or perhaps insurance bodies, or perhaps service providers. Properly prepared guidelines will reflect the views of all stakeholders, and probably everybody should get a say, and probably people with different perspectives are entitled to different views. So as long as there's adequate representation of stakeholders, and it's explicit who those stakeholders are, who the people are who are developing the guidelines, I see that overall as being quite a good thing.
Okay. So we've talked a bit about where evidence-based practice came from and sort of where we've come to today with it. Where do you see evidence-based practice going in the future?
It's always hard to predict the future. We've got in the physiotherapy profession now a fairly large and established group of people doing research. That's new. We have, you know, there's now masses of PhD students and young postdocs who are expecting to spend a career doing research, and that's going to change the face of the profession. It's going to mean we have much more evidence than we used to have, and I think it's going to demand of physiotherapists a bit more sophistication as consumers of research. And I think we're going to see more sophisticated research as well. I think we're going to see people start tackling the problems that have plagued evidence-based practice for the last 20 years. Issues to do with individualization of decision-making. Making predictions about the outcomes of individuals, making decisions about for what the best treatment is for a particular individual. It's something that that people have complained about, professionals have complained about since the beginning of evidence-based practice, and it's sort of been ignored by the evidence-based medicine and evidence-based physiotherapy people, not because it's not a real question, but because there haven't really been any technical solutions to that problem. We've really been forced to deal with statements about averages, about average people, and you know, maybe in the next few decades we'll see better ways of dealing with that.
It's quite worrying to hear you say that there's going to be more evidence that we have to deal with. There's going to be more out there that we need to sift through. So I'm hoping that Pedro is going to sift through it all for us. And
please. Yeah, and Physiopedia will put it out there for us in a nice, convenient format.
Yeah, we're going to have a lot of work to do.
I don't see more evidence as a problem. I see it as a good thing.
Yeah.
But we will need mechanisms to help people access that. And, of course, those mechanisms have been getting built in parallel with the development of new research. You know, Pedro is just one example of that. Physiopedia is another. But there are many guidelines in general are another mechanism. So these are things that people didn't even think about 20 years ago, but they're established and in practice now, and we'll have new mechanisms, no doubt, in the next 10 or 15 years.
Yeah. So moving forward, what is your advice for physios to currently take, use evidence-based practice in their clinical practice at in this sort of current state that we're in at the moment?
I think one useful, well, what I say to a lot of clinicians, and particularly to soon-to-be graduated students, is don't feel any obligation to do research. In some places I go, people feel like there's some moral obligation for them to be out there doing research. Well, these days I don't think that obligation exists. There's plenty of research people, plenty of people who are getting PhD theses for what they do, or getting paid as a postdoc, or getting paid as an academic to do research. If you don't feel an inclination and don't have the training to do research, then I don't think you should do it. I don't think it's even necessary these days. But I think every physiotherapist should feel an obligation to use research, that is, to read it, understand it, and incorporate it into their clinical practice. I think we do have a moral obligation to do that. It's a professional obligation. And that means that physiotherapists should see the capacity to read and critically appraise and use research in the same way as any other part of their professional training. It's something they should be able to do. And if they're not doing it, then they're probably not satisfying their professional obligations.
That's good, wise words of advice, I think, definitely. And if we all take that practice forward, then we're definitely going to advance our credibility, as we discussed earlier, within as healthcare providers. Not that we need to now, because we have a credible profession, but that's something we should all be doing to help the profession move it forward.
At the end of it all, knowledge is power. It's a slogan, but it's sort of true. If physiotherapists can back up what they do with reference to high quality research, if they can understand what it is that they're talking about, then they have a right to a high degree of professional autonomy. Yeah. If they can't, they don't.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's quite important conversation, or something to think about for the countries that where they aren't autonomous as a physiotherapy profession, and there still are countries like that around the world. And then one of the other things about knowledge, and this is one of my little bugbears, is that people that are practicing, reading the research, developing their knowledge from it and taking it into practice, they keep it to themselves, and I want them all to share it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Everybody develops their own little piece of knowledge, and if everybody shared just that a piece of knowledge that they're working on with everybody else, then our whole knowledge base becomes much stronger. It's easy to share. And so I, for the future, I'm looking for people to be sharing this knowledge that they're developing through their evidence-based practice work.
In the old days, medicine had, you know, grand rounds, and it had, the honorary would do his rounds. It was always a him, and the interns would trail around after him. But there was, they were kind of strange mechanisms, but they were formal mechanisms for passing knowledge on from experienced people to junior people. And in physiotherapy, we haven't had that same tradition. We haven't had those same clinical mechanisms. But maybe these days, what we've got is the internet. We've got mechanisms. We've got bloggers.
Yeah.
We've got Physiopedia. We've got a whole lot of mechanisms for sharing knowledge that weren't available before. And physiotherapists seem to be pretty quick on the uptake for electronic sharing of information. So that's something that's in our favour.
I think we're sharing more electronically now. It's taken us a while. I think in Australia you're a bit quicker than everyone else on the electronic uptake. Everywhere else is coming on better now, yeah, and that's a good thing. So is there anything else you want to share with everyone about evidence-based practice? We've covered quite a few topics. Is there anything that I've missed out that I haven't thought about that we ought to talk about?
Well, I suppose one thing I'd just like to make clear, because I know there'll be people out there listening. Maybe they won't be listening to me if they think like this, but there are a lot of people out there who think that evidence-based practice is just about randomised controlled trials. That's not at all what it's about. It's a very important component of how we know about the effects of therapy. But of course, there are many questions in clinical practice that need all sorts of other research designs. And I want to emphasise the fact that we need the whole spectrum of research. Qualitative researchers often feel left out of the evidence-based practice game. I don't think they need to. I think there's a really important role for qualitative researchers and qualitative research in evidence-based practice. And I really hope that our profession manages to avoid the sort of quantitative qualitative wars that have plagued some other health professions. We don't need that sort of thing. We can probably work it out and get on together and all contribute.
And on that note, do you think there's a place as well for people just, I mean, some people maybe want to share some of their research or share some of their work with the research database that we have as a profession, but are unable to actually do the research? Do you think there's a place for people just sharing simply case studies and things like that?
sure, there's a place for case studies. I actually think you've got to start with an important clinical question.
Yeah.
You can't start with data. In general, exercises which involve enthusiastic clinicians collecting lots of data and then wondering what they're going to do with it don't go very far. You're much better off starting with an important clinical question and then working out how to answer it. So I've seen occasions where incidentally collected data has yielded useful information, but I don't think it happens very often. And I think a lot of well-meaning people go out there and collect an awful lot of data, which in the end doesn't get very far. It's much better to have a question first and then collect data. As for case studies, they have a limited role. They can tell us about, they can give us ideas, they can give us proof of concept, they can tell us about strange things that you might see very occasionally, but they don't have a role really in helping us decide what are good therapies and what are bad therapies. So I think they might be a bit overdone myself.
Okay, that's fair enough. Good. So the only other thing that we haven't talked about is your book, and we must mention your book, that you wrote a book, well, with your co-authors, is that right?
That's right.
A Practical Evidence-Based Physiotherapy in 2011. What led you to writing that book?
Yeah, that was the second edition. The first edition, I think, was 2005.
Right.
What led us to it? Gry Jamtvedt and Kåre Børge Hagen were in Norway and had written a book in Norwegian that was very popular, and were working in positions where they were doing really, I think, pioneering thinking about evidence-based practice. Judy Mead had been in the UK and had been one of the authors, along with Tracy Beery and a number of other contributors, to what I think might have been the first textbook on evidence-based physiotherapy published in English. And I'd been working with colleagues on Pedro, and actually a commissioning editor from Elsevier came and got us together and said, "Do you want to write a book?" And we kind of liked each other, so we did. We got together in Norway, and then later in the UK and in Italy to work on it, and we had a lot of fun writing it together, and it was a very useful collaboration.
Oh, good. And it's a book to help clinicians implement evidence-based practice, isn't it? Is it a practical guide to actually implementing evidence-based practice?
It's practical in the sense that it's about answering clinical questions, and it's structured around a mechanism for answering clinical questions. Of course, it's a bit theoretical as well. There's lots of discussion about research design and what it means, but the end objective is to help clinicians make evidence-based decisions.
Perfect. And that's what we are needing people to do. So very useful book, I imagine. I haven't actually read it myself. I haven't got a copy. But we've got a couple of your chapters available for people to maybe preview the book as well. So that's great.
I'll send you, Rachel.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, well, Rob, it's been lovely to talk to you today. Is there any final message you'd like to add to the conversation?
No. I think that's it from me.
Yeah, it's been really great to talk to you, and you definitely helped me with my thinking about evidence-based practice, which I haven't actually thought about for a while. So it's been very useful. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Rachel.